Jane Dunlop was my manager at Clark Wilmot for many years. She was the most remarkable person you could ever meet. So Jane was a mother of four and friend of, you know, of nearly everybody, you know, who ever met her. She showed me that you could have a successful career and raise children, and you could balance both. I remember, first of all, Jane starting to become ill, and the day she telephoned me and I was off work, and she turned around to me at that point and said, "I don't think this is good news, is it, Kat?" And, you know, it felt very ominous. When she died, it was horrendous.
Hello and welcome to Life, Lemons and the Law, a Clark Wilmot podcast series discussing life-changing experiences of all kinds with the people involved. We'll talk about the immediate impact of those events and the long-term, often very positive outcomes. On this episode, we have Kat Quinton and Philippa Han. And we're talking about particularly difficult moments in their lives, along with, importantly, the shared and quite specific way that they've both found really helps in dealing with these experiences. Kat, can I ask you to introduce yourself?
Yep, I am Kat Quinton. I am now Head of Information Security and Data Protection at Clark Wilmot. I have been at Clark Wilmot for 25 years this year, so an awful long time. Mother of two, guardian of one, stepmother to, you know, a few others, and an ultra runner as well.
We'll come on to the ultra running. Philippa is here as well.
My name is Philippa Han. I am Managing Director of the Core Litigation Division. I'm a relative newcomer. I've only been at Clark Wilmot for 15 years.
Fantastic. So, Kat, can I ask you to tell us a little bit more about Jane Dunlop?
So I met Jane back in 1997. I'd first started at Clark Wilmot in 97, and I was seconded to her team. There was this wonderful boss, Jane, who at the end of every single day did what became the most important thing to me, and that was just said thank you.
If you were to do a straw poll of the people that knew her, how would they describe her?
Oh, they would describe her as determined, but loving. So Jane was a mother of four, and ultimately became grandmother to many and friend of, you know, of nearly everybody, you know, who ever met her. She showed me that you could have a successful career and raise children, and you could balance both. And that was really, really important to me. I dropped out of university, you know, deciding not to, at that point in time, I thought I decided to not pursue a career in law. There were other priorities in my life at that point in time. I had stepchildren, and I didn't want it to be a kind of sort of all or nothing. And she really showed me that you could work, you could study at the same time, you could provide for your family, and you could support your family, and you could be there for your kids. And that was Jane. And she threw herself into absolutely everything. She became a legal executive, and she became one of the first legal executives in the country to become a partner in a law firm. Quite remarkable. And to have her as a mentor was just fantastic. And it was Jane, in the end, who encouraged me to study. And then, you know, ultimately I became a legal executive. And then as the years went on, became an associate, senior associate, and then a partner at Clark Wilmot.
Jane obviously was an enormous influence on you. How did her death affect you?
It was horrendous. I remember, first of all, Jane starting to become ill, and the day she telephoned me and I was off work that day to say that she had a call back from her doctor to go and see him. And she turned around to me at that point and said, "I don't think this is good news, is it, Kat?" And, you know, it felt very ominous. When she died, it was incredibly difficult because, you know, not only had I lost, you know, the person that had become, you know, an absolute best friend to me for many, many years, you know, we'd lost this amazing mentor as well. And yet we had to carry on, deal with our own grief and try to keep the business running as well. We had, you know, countless clients and, you know, people that we were supporting. And that I felt was really difficult. I was already not in a particularly sort of mentally well patch. And that had been building up for a little while. And then when, you know, when Jane died, you know, it was a real struggle. after Jane's death, and probably for a little while after, I felt, you know, incredibly depressed. There were lots of other things going on in life added to that. It was a real struggle to do things. The stress was starting to get to me, and there were points where, you know, I would be, you know, almost sort of frozen in sending emails. I just lost all confidence. You know, that was really hard, and I lost a lot of self-confidence over a period of time, and felt very, very low. I tried to hide it for a lot of the time, but I felt very low. It was very difficult to get up in the morning.
Okay, so Philippa, when did you first meet Kat, and where was she in an emotional sense?
Kat and I think we were aware of each other's presence, but I mean, we really started to meet when I became MD of the Core Litigation Division. And I remember coming down to meet you in the Taunton offices and being faced with amazing, amazing people. And the reputation of Brew across the firm is superb, and they are a force to be reckoned with. When we first met during that period, of course, Kat had her kind of professional hat on, and you wouldn't have known that she was going through anything. And we developed our relationship over a period of some months. And over that period, we got closer and closer, didn't we, Kat, and chatted. And then there was the conversation that happened just prior to Christmas, I think 2 years ago, where Kat was in a really difficult place. And it was a hard conversation as a manager. It's always hard when you're dealing or you're working with somebody who is going through a very difficult period of time. And this was some years after Jane's death. I mean, you had by that point taken over leadership alongside Phil and Anna and were doing an amazing job. But at home, things were quite difficult for you. And there was a conversation that we had, which I hope you don't mind me talking about, which centered around Kat being really at the end of her ability to cope with what life was throwing at her. And Kat's son has quite a significant illness, and the doctors were changing the medication for him. And the phrase that stuck with me was Kat being so amazingly honest with me around how hard life was for her, when she said, you know, I wake up every morning and I walk down the landing to my son's bedroom and I don't know whether I'm going to find him alive or dead. And that's just, I can't imagine just how hard that was for you. And at that point, I think our relationship changed from a professional one to one where there was some real brutal honesty around the conversations we were having about how we were doing. Everyone has something going on that is hard in their lives.
Philippa, that kind of emotional low, the depths of that anxiety, is that something you can relate to?
That's a really hard question, isn't it? Whether my depths are the equivalent of somebody else's depth is something that I don't think any of us can ever answer. Have I had difficulties and low times? Absolutely, of course. You know, my marriage broke down a couple of years ago, and that was a very hard time. It was a very hard time. And there were points during that journey where I was very alone, very on my own, and struggling to manage everything that was on my shoulders, I suppose.
Philippa, you mentioned when we were prepping this podcast a little bit about your friends who have children with a life-limiting illness. Can you tell us a bit about your friends and their children?
So my absolute best friend in the whole world is a woman called Tanya. Tanya and I met at university, and 25 years later, we are the best of friends. So we did everything together. We sort of finished university at the same time, bought houses, got married, and went through those big life milestones at the same time and shared a lot of experiences. And we both got pregnant at about the same time. Her babies were due 5 weeks after my first child. And she didn't know at that point that she was pregnant with identical twins. And so we both had maternity leave at the same time, and we would always call on a Friday and have these long conversations about teething and all the rest of it as they went through that toddler stage where they're all learning to walk, etc. She said, it's really weird. She said, the boys just, they can't seem to stop moving around. They're not really steady on their feet. I will never forget the conversation we had, and I said to her, oh, go and speak to the health visitor. How bad can it be? And it turned out that it was really bad. It is a life-limiting condition, which is quite similar to sort of multiple sclerosis and cystic fibrosis. They weren't my children, and so I can't claim the devastation that was felt by my friend, but it was a devastating diagnosis. And I think we're so used to solving things, aren't we? We're so used to fixing things, and this was something that nobody could fix, nobody could solve. And actually, that's really hard when you see a friend struggling, when you see someone that close to you who is suffering so much pain. You just want to make it better, you want to make it okay, and you can't. And that's a really hard thing, actually, when you can't make it better. And so I had to learn to stop trying to fix it. I had to learn to stop trying to make it okay, because it wasn't okay. And actually, I had to learn to stay with someone who was grieving. I had to learn to stay with someone who was sad. And that is something that I think we're not necessarily used to doing.
Philippa, without wanting to be abrupt, I'm going to go back to Kat now. And Kat, what steps did you take to begin to move yourself forward?
After Jane died, and I knew that I wasn't in a particularly great place, and I felt I really wanted to do something. I dabbled in running a little bit, and I kind of sort of felt this urge to do something very kind of physical and to raise some money for a charity, for both, you know, the charity that supported Jane, and also muscular dystrophy, as my stepson had passed away with that, you know, a number of years before. And I felt I could, you know, really kind of chuck myself into something positive. So I decided to sign up at that point in time to the London Marathon, but I got horribly rejected. And I felt really kind of disappointed. And I thought, well, the London Marathon, that's what people do. That's what they do to raise money. And I don't even know what it was or where I saw it, but I suddenly saw this ultra marathon that looked, you know, particularly kind of interesting. And thought, oh, why not? I'll just sign up for, you know, 100 kilometres over 2 days. You know, never done it before. You know, I'll just chuck myself into that. That sort of started my love for long distance running, because I just felt that if I had nothing else other than work and, you know, my family, who were, you know, all awesome, but if I didn't have anything for me, then actually I would start to struggle to, you know, to find a reason to kind of get up in the day. And that was the real, you know, the real kind of start of it. And then later on, as Philippa said, you know, had some really, you know, difficult situations when my son was diagnosed with epilepsy and a complex kind of neurological condition. Philippa was like my knight in shining armour, and accepted the offer of coaching with Cart Wilmot. And that's not running coaching. That was almost kind of life coaching. And that really was the kind of sort of, you know, revolutionary point. And it all has sort of snowballed since, really.
What? Why do you do it now?
Running now is, for me, is actually an end result of all the positive things in my life. I know that when I'm running, actually things are going well for me, because if I can keep running, then I know that my mental health is in a good place. When Jane first died, I only ever really ran alone, until I sort of joined a group of females that actually at that point in time, they were just getting into running. It was a, you know, a council initiative. And I joined actually saying, look, I run, but actually I don't want to run alone anymore. And I didn't sort of see myself fitting into a classic kind of sort of running group. And through that and through a number of races, I started to meet lots and lots of runners. I met some fantastic people, and there are so many people that I can call upon now and just say, hey, you know, should we go out at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning and, you know, do something kind of crazy? Should we go out and, you know, stand on Glastonbury Tor at 10 o'clock in the night? And some of those people have just become the best friends in the world. So I think it then created, you know, the fact that I threw myself into this, I created this amazing network of people. And that now includes, you know, Philippa, as well as the people outside of work.
Amazing. Philippa, why do you run?
There's always a million reasons, aren't there? And like Kat, the reason I started running wasn't the reason why I run now. I started running after I had a baby because I didn't want to be fat. And it was just something I could do really quickly whilst before my husband went to work, I could put my trainers on and I could dash out for like 20 minutes and come back. As you do more and more of it, and as you challenge yourself more and more with those longer and longer distances, you find out so much more about yourself and you get so much more from it.
Kat, how has it changed you? How has long distance running changed you psychologically, emotionally?
I've moved away from this person that needed that kind of constant affirmation of, you know, well done, Kat. You know, although, you know, people might say that when you get to the end of a massive race, I needed to feel that own self-worth. It's helped me become a much more positive person. My life now isn't, you know, work and kids, it's work, kids and adventures. You know, the excitement, the exhilaration of, you know, of running at night and sharing stories with other people, the anecdotes, the being cornered by cows, the hilarious things that happen, the sliding in mud. I mean, you know, those kind of adventures as an adult, you really have to kind of sort of seek those out. But they are what makes life.
One of the really important things to know about running is, and this sounds really daft, but it's not linear. Like, there's nothing straight line about running. You have high points and low points, and you have good points and bad points. I used to have this romantic notion that actually I should go for a run when the mood took me, and that I should love every moment of running, and that if I wasn't a real runner unless I did that. And I think a lot of running is not that. A lot of running is going out when you don't want to go out.
Was there a particular point at which you decided to make a transition from running in order to maintain your health to pushing yourself psychologically, physically with these extreme events? Because there seems to me to be a difference between those two things.
So, yeah. Yeah. My marriage was failing and there was a lot going on. My career was and is very demanding. But there wasn't much of me going on. And I can be one of life's pleasers. I had to prove to everyone that everything was okay, and I had to make sure that everybody was okay. And there was a pride in putting myself last. And yet I have no badges. No one has given me one damn badge. And I ended up with that crushing feeling that I was last and that I was responsible for everybody else. And what I found was that with my running, that was the only time I was on my own. That was the only time I had any space. I didn't have anyone leaning on me. Did a 10K, thought about doing a half marathon, and that joy and confidence in me and what I could do with my own two feet grew. I just found it really exciting because people like me aren't supposed to do things like that. I'm supposed to be working or mothering. I'm not supposed to be gallivanting off open water swimming and doing events like that. There was a joy and still is a joy in me being unreasonable. And so it grew from there, and I decided that I would do something scary every year. So I did the half Ironman and then I did a 100-mile ultra marathon with some of my colleagues, which was incredible and amazing. And this year I did my first full Ironman. It was the most incredible experience of my life. When you do things that you know to be important, which are uncomfortable in the immediate term, like running, actually they have the capacity to change your life. So it's not about waking up in the morning and singing a song about I can't wait to go for a run. It's about putting your trainers on when you don't want to go for a run. My perspective on the world, my filter on the world just feels so different, and feeling strong, feeling fit, feeling well, being able to sleep well, being able to cope with the things that life throws at me means I can be the mum I want to be. It means I can be the MD that I want to be. I can be the leader that I want to be. And I just think it's amazing. It's actual magic.